From WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Teich. Today on the program, how does Mike Lovell's move from UWM to Marquette shake up the leadership picture here? Later, two big performances this weekend spotlight the composer Handel and some unusual subject matter.
They talk about life is like a flower. Its setting is already in its dawn, and it loses its springtime in a single day. And it talks about the bee stinging, and you're going, oh my God, what was Handel thinking about?
And Milwaukee Magazine invites you on a figurative tour of some dream homes.
With this piece, we wanted to convey that feel of taking a Sunday drive through neighborhoods and translate that to the magazine page.
Lake Effect comes your way next after news from NPR and Milwaukee Public Radio. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Teich. Thank you so much for tuning in today. Marquette University yesterday announced that Michael Lovell will be the 24th president in the school's history and the first lay leader of the Jesuit institution. His choice was unanimous by the college's board of trustees. Lovell comes across town from his position as chancellor at UW-Milwaukee, a position he's held since 2011. Speaking yesterday, Lovell talked about the decision to leave public higher education for the position at Marquette.
And so my faith has always served as a cornerstone in my life. And having the ability to openly practice my religious beliefs in my professional career is something that I've always wanted to do. Likewise, servant leadership is at the fundamental core of what I believe in practice.
Just over 2 years ago, Lovell was on the cover of Milwaukee Magazine for an article that placed him squarely in the center of the new guard of Milwaukee leaders. Kurt Chandler wrote that article. He's now the editor at the magazine. He and senior editor Howie Magner join us this morning to talk about some of the ramifications of the shakeup in the higher education scene here. Welcome to you both.
Good to see you, Mitch. Thanks.
How are you doing, Mitch?
I'm doing well, thanks. Let me quote from the cover of the January 2012 issue of Milwaukee Magazine. There's this big picture of Mike Lovell, and next to it is the question, will new execs like UWM Chancellor Mike Lovell reshape Milwaukee? Realizing that you wrote that article a while ago, Kurt Chandler, what was it about Mike Lovell that has made him all these years so highly thought of by so many people, do you think?
A very impressive guy, and I think he's done a good job in the 3.5 years at UWM. He came up as a professor at UWM, and he really has a sort of a different mind for that position. I mean, he's got degrees in mechanical engineering, several of them as long as his arm. His vita is very impressive. But he also is a person who is really willing to give. I've heard many things about his commitment to servitude, you know, professional as well as personal. And I think that he was always, according to people I know who work for him or work at UWM, he was always willing to reach out to others. I think that impressed us when we did the story, asking on the cover if he and others were a face of the future. And certainly it looks like he is. He's taken another step up the ladder here locally.
Would you consider it a step up the ladder to go from UWM to Marquette in this way?
Well, not to offend anybody here at WUWM or at UWM, I think it's a step up the ladder in terms of prestige in a way. Nationally, it's a more well-known university, and I think it's maybe a step up in college tiers. Also, I think it'll be a better salary for him. When he looks at a salary of a, at this point, nameless former Marquette basketball coach who was making $2.8 million, Lovell was making $343,505 as of last October.
That's not as much money as head coach Rob Jeter was making, I believe, for coaching the UW men's basketball team.
A lot has been made of the relative salaries of high-level college coaches versus university presidents and chancellors.
Well, in many ways, the basketball coaches at schools like UWM and Marquette are more the face of the institution than a chancellor or a president would be. Now, you may disagree with whether that's right or wrong, but that's simply the way it is. They're in many ways the head of the marketing department for the schools that they coach for.
Kurt, you've been in this community a long time. Do you think the broader community views UWM any differently today under Mike Lovell's leadership than it did in the past?
I think so. I think he really was striving and had made gains on increasing the profile of UWM, moving it more towards a research university, and he did a really good job at fundraising. He was bringing in the money. I'm sure that's one reason why Marquette looked to him as a candidate for presidency.
There's this comparison that a number of people have raised since the announcement Wednesday morning. The last chancellors to leave UWM, Carlos Santiago and Nancy Zimpher, essentially left town never to be heard from again, at least here. Mike Lovell remains very much on the higher education and the broader scene in Milwaukee, which seems a little unprecedented for a place like this.
Well, in what way?
Well, just in the sense that this is a very significant departure for UWM, but it's not a departure for the city of Milwaukee.
Well, it is very unusual. I think, though, that what meshes here for Lovell is his Catholicism. That's what he said at press conference on Wednesday, and that's what he said in his statement. So I think it's a pretty good fit for him. He, as I said before, really believes in giving back to the university personally, giving back to the community. It's this spirit, this commitment to servitude, and that really is in line with the Marquette mission. I mean, the Marquette mission says, I've got it right here, that Marquette strives to develop men and women who will dedicate their lives to the service of others, actively entering into the struggle for a more just society. And I think that is what attracted him to this position.
Along those lines, though, what is your sense for the significance of Marquette selecting a lay leader after all of these years? Does it say something about the changing reality of a religious institution like Marquette?
Well, maybe it does. Maybe they're looking for somebody, I don't know, who is somewhat unencumbered by some of the tenets of the Catholic Church, of the Vatican itself. So maybe they can pay a bit more to this president who, you know, certainly doesn't have to take a vow of poverty. He's not a priest, but maybe that frees him up to be more of a businessman, more of a CEO. Other university presidents from Marquette have done a swell job at fundraising, of course, and they had been priests. But maybe this is a different direction in terms of the role they'll use him in as the president. It remains to be seen, but I'd love to have been in those interviews, you know, with the finalists.
Speaking of transitions, Howie Magner, the other element to the story is how the news might affect Marquette's effort to find a new basketball coach. A lot has been made of the hesitance some potential coaches might have in coming here without either a permanent president or an athletic director in place. How big a difference does the president part of that equation mean to the search for a new coach?
Well, I think it's very important. And if you read some of the reports, that's one of the reasons why Buzz Williams left, is because he was uncomfortable with the instability at the higher levels of the school, be it with the presidency or be it with the athletic director, be it with their conference affiliation in the Big East, maybe not being as stable as the ACC is, which is what Virginia Tech is a member of, the school that he ended up at. But if you're a basketball coach, and certainly a high-profile basketball coach of the nature that Marquette is trying to attract, you want to know the people who you're going to be working for. You want to be comfortable and have a certain level of trust with those people. And the president is a big part of that. So and if you're the president, you probably want to have some sort of say in the basketball coach who's going to be representing your school. So there was a lot of conjecture about whether or not Marquette could hire a basketball coach before it could hire not just a president, but an athletic director as well. My guess is now that the president is in place, that will be enough to attract a coach. And
sort of a reverse domino effect.
Yeah, exactly. You know, and the early rumor, the hot rumor earlier this week was that it was going to be Shaka Smart, and some people went out and went so far as said that it was a done deal. Obviously, it's not a done deal yet, or Shaka Smart would have, you know, been introduced as the head basketball coach. There are some people who are still holding out hope that Shaka Smart will be the coach. Reports out of Virginia Commonwealth University are that he has told people down there he's not going anywhere. That takes you to the second choice for Marquette. Many reports are that Ben Howland, the former UCLA coach who before that was at Pittsburgh. Apparently, Mike Lovell has some Pittsburgh connections as well. So people are maybe putting together two and two and getting four and saying that Ben Howland will be the next coach. I can tell you this. Marquette will have a basketball coach next season. And he should be a guy with a pretty good resume because Marquette can pay a lot of money to its basketball coach. And even though Buzz Williams was ready to move on, that doesn't mean, even though he may have had some issues with the program and some issues with the conference, that doesn't mean it's not a bad basketball job. It's a very good basketball job that can put significantly more resources into its program than almost any other school out there, save for Duke.
Interestingly, you know, for as high a profile as Mike Lovell is as a hire for the presidency at Marquette, the face of Marquette is still likely to be its basketball coach on a national level.
Well, that's what we alluded to earlier in our conversation, Mitch. I mean, like it or not, basketball is big business on the college playing field. It's almost like your main marketing outreach program. I mean, a lot of people choose to go to Marquette or Wisconsin or Duke based upon their athletic programs, and it's free advertising. When you're playing a game on national television, as Marquette does often, your name is getting out there. You're seeing what the atmosphere is, the students there. You're putting ads on TV. It really is an important part of Marquette's image on a national basis. And, you know, if you're not winning, then that image takes a hit. And so that's why I think Marquette pours so many resources into it. Again, I alluded to the fact that, you know, only Duke pays more money per basketball player than Marquette does. That's a hefty statement when you're talking about a school that, you know, right here in Milwaukee that has had success, but I don't think Marquette's basketball program is considered one of the blue blood national basketball programs like a UCLA or a Kentucky, or even, you know, at the risk of offending Marquette people, Indiana, which Tom Crean left for. So, but it's not because Marquette's not willing to put the resources into that program. It certainly is. And that's why many people believe that even though Buzz Williams left, Marquette won't have a problem attracting a high-profile coach.
I agree with what you're saying, Howie, but maybe more so on a national level. I think on a local level, maybe it's less the basketball coach that is a draw than the university itself, Marquette University, and maybe the president himself. Now you've got somebody coming in who's a known quantity and will draw from the local pool maybe as much, maybe not quite as much as who the heck is the basketball coach. But he is a known quantity. He's got a reputation here. And parents and would-be students might look to the university, Marquette, as a place where they would want to go.
Well, certainly I could see if you're a businessman who has had success working with Mike Lovell at UWM, that would give you a certain level of comfort in working with him at Marquette as well.
One thing that we haven't talked about at all is what this means for UWM in its next search for a new chancellor. In the last few brief moments, so what do you think UWM should be looking to? More of another Mike Lovell out there?
Well, to some degree, yes. UWM is really hurting at this point. I talked to a couple of people at the university, and they were caught unaware. A few people knew on Tuesday that he was going to make the announcement, but most didn't. One person I talked to said he'd love to see Lovell continue for another 5 years, of course, you know, keep him in there because there's so much more to do that he started. But that's always the case. There's always a lot more to do. And he has been bombarded with offers from recruiters all over the place. It's been nonstop. So he, you know, but he stuck around for 3.5 years. And that's about the average, I think, for chancellors. Going forward, well, frankly, I think the regents are going to maybe have to cough up a little bit more money if they want to continue to raise the profile of UWM, and I think that might be a big part of the debate here.
Well, Kirk Chandler, Howie Magner, thanks so much.
Thanks, Mitch.
Thanks a lot, Mitch.
Kirk Chandler and Howie Magner of Milwaukee Magazine. Chandler's article on Michael Lovell and Milwaukee's new generation of leadership ran in the magazine back in January of 2012. They spoke with us yesterday after the announcement that Lovell would leave his role as UWM chancellor to become president at Marquette University. That move takes effect in August. Keep listening after the break. A big weekend coming up in Milwaukee for fans of Baroque music. We'll try to get a handle on it as Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio. Lake Effect continues on WUWM. I'm Mitch Teich. This weekend, the glorious Baroque sounds of George Friedrich Handel will fill two concert venues in Milwaukee. A bit later in the show, we'll hear about the quieter side of Handel as Wauwatosa's ensemble musical offering presents a chamber concert of his music on Saturday. But first, it's Florentine Opera's production of Julius Caesar, which plays tomorrow and Sunday evenings at the Marcus Center's Eline Hall. The Florentine has been successfully presenting Baroque opera since 2009. Tellingly, that first production was also one of Handel's. In this production of Caesar, the company has brought in director Eric Einhorn, who has staged productions at New York City's Metropolitan Opera, as well as soprano Ava Pine to sing Cleopatra and mezzo-soprano Deanne Meek to sing the role of Caesar. All three joined Lake Effect's Bonnie North to talk about the production, and Einhorn explains what excites him about working on this opera.
Handel takes this very familiar piece of history and gives us events we think we know a lot about, but gives us these incredible three-dimensional characters that at the root of Caesar and Cleopatra and Sesto and Cornelia, everybody in the show, they're all going through these very basic human emotions from love and loss to triumph, all in the context of these very familiar events. But Handel gives us a door deeper into who these people are, and that's where I think Handel is so magnificent, and that's what we're trying to pull out and bring to the forefront, these very real people in the midst of these historical events.
And he does it with such beautiful music.
He does.
You know, some of the arias that are in this particular opera are just heartbreakingly beautiful.
Absolutely.
And I'm going to bring the two singers in here. Deanne, you are Julius Caesar, and Ava, you are Cleopatra. And approaching these two iconic, well, figures as well as roles, you know, what do you do? How do you prepare for something like this? And Deanne, we'll start with you.
Well, I certainly started with history, just getting to know this character as well as I could historically. And then I went to Shakespeare just for fun. Not that they relate so much in terms of the actual story in relation to Handel, but I certainly read and went to a whole bunch of different Shakespeare productions of Julius Caesar, which was good fun.
Yeah, he didn't use that as his libretto, did he?
No, it was something. It's an original libretto.
Okay.
Yeah.
No, it was just different takes on character. I happened to go to a production that featured an all-woman cast in Julius Caesar in New York, and so that was quite fun because I got to really see other people embodying this iconic hero figure. And also look at the relationships in different ways. So I kind of like to look at the character and the process from many different directions and angles. So those were some of the big ways that I prepare. And then, of course, just going to the text and looking at the relationships.
And learning the music.
Yeah. That always happens.
Yeah. And Ava, for you?
Well, one of the things I was struck by when I first started learning this role was how little we actually know about Cleopatra. There were several different women named Cleopatra in her family line. And we don't know for sure that we actually even have a picture of what she looks like. So as an actor, that gives me extraordinary freedom to kind of create the character that my version of Cleopatra, which is different from the Shakespeare version of Cleopatra, which is different from the Elizabeth Taylor version of Cleopatra. And she really is she's a mythical figure. She's like a shell. You get to imbue her with whatever you feel like she is at that moment. And actually, she's a bit of a chameleon in general, and that's also fun as an actor.
Well, and also, you know, you get to humanize her, as Eric was saying, you know, making her somebody that we care about, not just this icon or somebody we think we know out of history, but,
absolutely,
you know, an actual person who has issues and problems and things that she wants and doesn't want.
One of my favorite resources was a Margaret George book called The Memoirs of Cleopatra. And it was basically this author getting into Cleopatra's head and imagining how she felt during some of these events. Total fiction, but really interesting to read because I was about to create my own version of that fiction.
Eric, one of the things this production is doing is having Deanne play Julius Caesar. Now, is that normally sung by a mezzo or are there productions where a baritone is used?
The performance practice is a little mixed that in modern productions, it can either be a mezzo, it can be a baritone, it can be a countertenor. That's one of the most amazing things about the role of Julius Caesar is that it, depending on how it's cast, can really shape how the role is performed, whether it's a woman doing it or a man doing it or what voice type. It completely changes the color and the approach, and that's one of the exciting things about doing opera are those choices.
Was this your choice to have a mezzo in the role, or was that something that Florentine decided?
That was a Florentine decision, but couldn't be happier about the decision.
So how does that, having a woman in the role, affect the way you approach it as a director?
Well, I think for me it's always about finding that simple human truth. One could approach it as to say, well, what is it like for a woman to be playing a man, and what's that physicality like, that transformation? But in this circumstance, it's a little less important than something like Marriage of Figaro, where you have a Cherubino, a woman supposed to be a little boy, where the physicality plays into it much more. That the way the opera is structured, the character of Caesar, I think, is more universal, and whether it's a man or a woman doing it is less important as to what this person is experiencing.
And what is this person experiencing, Deanne? What is Julius Caesar experiencing in this particular take on the story?
Oh, gosh. He really runs the gamut. I mean, he's got a very complex life in this show. You know, he comes in as triumphant and victorious, and then he immediately goes to rage and a sense of disappointment, and there's trouble in River City. There's a big problem, which comes across very early in the show. And then he falls in love. And then he faces death, and he has a wonderful scene where he, at the end of the show, where he really comes to terms with his own and all men's the frailty of life and how quickly it can end. And there's a real depth and profundity to his observations about just the ephemeral nature of life for all of us. And then he's saved, and then he's in love, and then he's happy. And, you know, he really has a really wonderful range that he gets to experience.
So as an actor, you get to go everywhere.
Yeah, you're really all over the place. And part of the challenge of the role is to find the core of who he is within all those extremes of emotions and all of those rich experiences. I did want to add to Eric's earlier observation about the different characters and the different types of voices that can play Caesar. It's important for people to know that the original singer in this was a castrato. And so, you know, I'm embodying a role that was created by a man with a very unique vocal range and ability. And that determines a great deal of what I do as a singer. But also, it in a way, because we don't have those anymore, that opens the field up to, as Eric was saying, so many different ways of creating this role and of hearing this role, because we don't really in our modern day have a corollary.
Ava, for you, though, it's a much more traditional – it was – originally sung by a woman, Cleopatra?
It was written for Francesca Cuzzoni, who was one of the legendary dueling divas. Handel threatened to throw one or both of them out the window at one point. But she was tremendous, and some of the most amazing music for soprano was written for her. And singing this role, I have a theory that she is superhuman because these arias are just brilliant and difficult and long and such challenges to sing and act. And I have such tremendous respect for this woman who said, okay, I'm good with what you've written for me, and I'm going to lay this down for the rest of time, that it must be done this way. There's an aria that's just pure coloratura, and then there's an aria that's pure legato, and it just requires a great vocal range to be able to do it in style and in notes, actually.
And Dan, you were saying before we turned on the microphones that you were listening to YouTube for different kinds of ornamentation, and I wanted to talk about that with both of you. The Baroque period is known for its ornamentation and for, you know, its expectation that singers and musicians would be able to improvise on things. And so how do you decide? Is this something that you do individually? Do you decide with the conductor, you know, what you're going to use and how you're going to ornament each of your arias?
Well, for me, it's part of the preparation process. I've worked with conductors who have sent out their version of what they'd like the ornaments to be. And so when that happens, I'll work with them. And, you know, I always come with ideas too, because ornamentation is a very personal thing. You use that return of the A section to show off what you do best, perhaps to hide what you don't do quite as well. And it really becomes very personal. And for me, I learn the structure of the piece, I learn the notes, and then I just get it stuck in my head and I make up things and I ornament in the car and I ornament in the shower and I ornament walking down the street. And then when I get back with the pianist, I'll make sure that the things I've come up with can work in the structure of the piece. But it's just about having fun with it. And I love it best when I ornament in a rehearsal process.
Yeah, likewise. And also, I often come with many, many ideas about what the ornaments will be, but until one gets with the conductor, for sure, but also the director, and you really understand what really is happening in that moment on stage between two people, that, to me, is what informs primarily the ornaments. And so you look to the ornaments as well as, in addition to the vocal demonstration, it also becomes about this is where we really tell more of the story, and we really use the ornaments to really articulate what it is going on for us internally, emotionally.
So, Eric, as the director, you're paying attention to what they're doing.
Absolutely.
In terms of that.
Right. And what will often happen is hearing what they do in rehearsal will inform how we take the scene, that if we're working on in one direction and all of a sudden an ornament comes out that completely sparks a new idea of trying something different, a change of emotion, a change of an acting beat. That, to me, is one of the most exciting things about working on Baroque opera, is that it's always changing. It's an organic thing versus something like a Puccini or a Verdi, where you're dealing with a far more linear narrative.
And more structured. I think people have certain expectations, and I think probably the composers did too. Things were more set down. I mean, the Baroque, like we were saying, there seems to be a lot of freedom for singers,
absolutely,
for directors, for musicians, right, you know, to be able to say, well, okay, we're going to go here. Almost like Commedia dell'arte, you know, there's your basic plot, here's your thing, but it's up to you to bring it to life.
Right. And like, as in with the Commedia, there are very strong boundaries within which you have tremendous freedom. So
yes,
that's an interesting juxtaposition.
Lots of room for individuality within the guidelines that you have.
Mm-hmm.
Quickly tell me about the setting that you've put this in, because you haven't set it in ancient Egypt, have you?
We have not. A way that I like to bring an audience into a Handel story, because it has a tendency to be very convoluted with a lot of characters we're not always familiar with. Caesar is a little different like that because we have some basis in history. But I really want to allow the audience to understand who these people are, whose team they play for, quickly, so that we can understand that and then get into the meat of the characters. So I tried to find a more contemporary setting that would allow the audience to identify these people clearly and quickly. And we found some great dramatic meat in Mussolini's occupation of Libya in the early 20th century. And as I've been saying for a while now and in rehearsals and as much as I can get out there, this is not a political statement. This is not this production with any agenda other than drawing the analogy between the strong Italian leader invading and occupying northern Africa, that the visuals, I think, paint a very clear picture in our minds and in live performance. And then from there, we deal strictly with Handel. We don't make any kind of fascist commentary or anything like that. It's just a way in.
I unfortunately am going to miss this because I will be out of the country, but I cannot wish you all enough good luck. This sounds like a fantastic production.
Thank you.
And I am so grateful that you came in this morning. I appreciate it.
It was a pleasure.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for having us.
Soprano Ava Pine, mezzo-soprano Deanne Meek, and stage director Eric Einhorn spoke with Bonnie North about the Florentine Opera's production of Handel's Julius Caesar. The opera opens tomorrow night at the Marcus Center's Eline Hall and will have a second performance on Sunday. Up next, the Handel music that fills in the donut hole between the two opera performances. We'll talk with the music director of Ensemble Musical Offering when Lake Effect returns on Milwaukee Public Radio. More of Lake Effect Now. I'm Mitch Teich. As we mentioned in the last segment, if you love the music of Handel, this is your weekend. On the dark night between Florentine Opera's two performances of Julius Caesar, you can hear a different side of the Baroque master. The Wauwatosa-based Ensemble Musical Offering will perform his Arcadian duets for two sopranos and continuo, one of the water music suites, and a concerto for bassoon. Artistic director Joan Parsley explained to Lake Effect's Bonnie North why she chose these particular pieces of music for this concert.
The Arcadian duets are something I've wanted to do for a long time. Everybody, of course, knows the Messiah inside and out, and you sing to it at Christmas time. But I tell you, you need to know that Handel used the Arcadian duets. He wrote them first. And in fact, when he wrote the Messiah in only 7 weeks, he had the Arcadian duets in mind. You have these wonderful Arcadian secular texts about life and love. And of course, that's not at all what the Messiah is about. If you look at some of them there, they talk about the flowers of life. And then they talk about life is like a flower. Its setting is already in its dawn and it loses its springtime in a single day. And it talks about the bee stinging and you're going, oh my God, what was Handel thinking about?
It was
his
springtime.
Lost love?
it was his springtime. And it also sounds like that these are more like Enlightenment texts.
Yeah, they are, very much so. And the tempos are very quick indeed. One of the things when you take a look at these Arcadian duets and you think about, oh, Baroque ornamentation and expression, all of that, you know, what should we do here? What should we do there? There really is no rule. The music is so highly decorated to begin with, especially in the outer movements. Each one of these Arcadian duets, Bonnie, is like a little mini cantata. They're in three movements, fast, slow, fast, slow. And you'll hear the music of His Yoke is Easy and also He Shall Purify, but you're going to hear it in a new way.
And so you'll recognize from the Messiah.
Absolutely. But when you see the translation, you're going to be thinking about what young woman stung Handel in his obese state.
Young man and old man's thoughts turn to love.
Yes, mm-hmm. Exactly. Yep. Very much so. But the ornamentation is really written in, although there are things that we do with it. And it's really also up to it's only four continuo, harpsichord and baroque cello. And we've got a superb baroque cellist. Tulio Rondon, who's from Venezuela and is now, he studied at The Hague. and is now teaching at UW-Eau Claire, who is working with us. So he's – and he is a handle expert. So we're very excited.
This is really exciting to have – I'm such a handle fan, and to have an entire weekend where, you know, where we can take a chance to hear different facets of his oeuvre that we don't normally get to hear.
Right. Absolutely. And the other thing, just one more little side note on the Arcadian duets – is that when you take a look at the music, there's no piano, there's no forte, none of that is marked. It all comes from the text. So it comes from the inspiration of the singer and how the singer and I and our continual player are interpreting it, how we look at each other at the time and what just automatically springs forth.
The text that he set this music to, we've been alluding to a young lady that Stung handled. Were they written for a particular person,
These duets, and there are a number of Arcadian little mini cantatas, the same two people, a soprano and a castrati, sang them. And it's very possible that the same soprano had a relationship with Handel.
But it was obviously somebody that he wrote for before.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Okay. Absolutely.
And what a perfect time, of course, spring.
Yes. Well, and that's a perfect time to do water music as well.
And is that part of the concert as well?
Yes. We're doing the G major suite. It's sometimes referred to as the flute suite of that set. It's very interesting when you take a look at the water music. This was music written not about the water. You know, when we've done Vivaldi like La Tempesta de Mare, or we've done Telemann's Hamburger Ebb and Flute, it was about the water and what happens when you're in the water. But this is music that was played on the water.
On a barge.
On the barge.
Yep.
But it was also played inside the chambers as well. So it wasn't just for outside music.
Oh, I guess I didn't know that. I thought it was always played, when it was first written, that it was played out on the water.
Well, yeah. there are three occasions starting in 715 that we know of where this was played, possibly even for the wedding of the Prince of Wales. But that hasn't really been, it hasn't really been authenticated. But you can take, again, the suites of the water music, not so much the fireworks music, but the water music, and they don't necessarily work together because some of them were done for other operas that he did, early operas, like Rinaldo, and they're kind of, in some ways, put together sloppily. And so you have to decide which of the movements that you really want to do. And there's nothing wrong with adding movements from other kinds of suites or music that he did.
I was going to say, he did it.
Yeah, he did it all the time.
Right. He borrowed from himself all the time.
And you begin to wonder, what did Handel actually write? Because we don't have an autographed score of the water music. We have some other things. There are other manuscripts, but there's not a signed autograph by Handel.
Is there any real concern that he didn't write them?
No.
No.
I think everyone thinks that he did.
And
the thing about what's wonderful about them, the water music, is that they really show off the wind instruments. And we have a dynamite trio of bassoon, baroque oboe, and recorder players that have been with us for some time. And though we don't always use woodwind players, this program really showcases a lot of woodwind playing because we also are doing two of the concerti grossi from the Opus 3 collection. as well.
Which are – you're sort of running the gamut of Handel. Because that Opus 3 stuff is wonderful.
Yes.
Yeah. And most people, if they know Handel at all, will recognize.
And though the Opus 3 collection, those are really the first of his orchestral works. When you listen to Opus 6, they're much more advanced compositionally. But we wanted to do some of the first things that Handel wrote. We're also doing one of the keyboard concertos. It's an organ concerto from Opus 4, number 2, but we're using a harpsichord. It works beautifully on harpsichord. And then this great symphonia where the bassoon is premiered. So all of these things, it's really a very enlightening program and a lot of music that people aren't familiar with, but enough that we hope it will get them to the concert. But we are very excited about Handel. It's the first time we've done an all-Handel program. So,
Joan Parsley, as always, it's such a pleasure to have you in the studio. And next time, bring your harpsichord.
I would be happy to.
Joan Parsley is Artistic Director of Ensemble Musical Offering. The group will present its Hallmarks of Handel concert on Saturday evening at the All Saints Cathedral on East Juneau Avenue in Milwaukee. There are links to more information at wuwm.com/lakeeffect. Parsley spoke with Bonnie North. Keep listening. One last break, and then the story behind some dream homes in the Milwaukee area. This is Lake Effect on WUWM. Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Tyke. From the Lake Michigan shoreline to the more rural lake country to the west, the Milwaukee area is home to some unique and distinctive homes. You might have passed some of these houses when you were out for a walk or a drive. Maybe your house is one of them. Writer Sarah Ray Lancaster went in search of the area's dream homes and the stories behind them for the cover story in April's Milwaukee Magazine. She joins us now with the backstory behind the backstories. Welcome back to the show.
Thank you very much. It's great to be back.
Well, let's talk about the overarching principle that drives this feature. It's a very photo-intensive feature on dream homes. But what was it that you set out to accomplish in both pictures and text in this piece?
With this piece, we wanted to convey that feel of taking a Sunday drive through neighborhoods and translate that to the magazine page. So using photos of the home, using descriptions of the home, and just speaking with even some of the homeowners and the architects behind the design. So really just to translate that, walking down the street, driving down the street, and all of a sudden this home just kind of catches your attention, piques your attention, and you stop. And you just take that moment to kind of wonder, what would life be like living within those walls?
Is there something distinctively Milwaukee about this approach? I mean, could you do this anywhere, or is there something, you know, particular to our mix of architecture?
I think with Milwaukee, it lends itself to Milwaukee, the story, because Milwaukee does have such a diverse landscape when it comes to architecture. We have the Victorians, we have the Federalist style, we have the Prairie style that Frank Lloyd Wright was known for. So it's this unique hodgepodge of different buildings. And I think Robert Greenstreet, the dean over at the School of Architecture and Urban Planning at UW-Milwaukee, said it best when he described the homes like teeth, where a home is a tooth. Together they make a smile, and if one of them is missing, if one of those homes gets torn down, it's noticeable. You see it in the landscape, and it's the culmination of all of the homes that really makes the impact.
How did you cast your net? How did you arrive at the houses that you featured?
Sure. That was a bit of a task, but it was a fun one. We talked to architects, contractors, people at the School of Architecture, and really just kind of among the editors and myself at the magazine, just talked about some of the homes that maybe we've seen driving through town.
So there was some driving at random or you know, the houses that it piqued your interest.
Absolutely, absolutely. They all kind of went into this mix. And then from there, we just set out whittling down the list to about 20, and I think we ended up with 12.
Once you identify a house that interests you, how do you go about finding out who the architect is and getting that architect to talk to you?
With that was actually a big help there with Robert Greenstreet. He has a lot of connections within the city, and so he was able to point me in the right direction of, you know, talk to this architect, talk to this firm. You might want to reach out to this design firm. And so that was really where that took place. And then once you ask an architect to talk about their projects, most of them are more than willing. They're their babies, and they're more than happy to talk about the time and effort that went into them.
These are really distinctive houses, all of them very different from one another. I think about perhaps, you know, my own little bungalow and you know, the kinds of houses that most of us live in, and we're unlikely to run out and buy a house that looks like one of these. But I wonder if there's an analogy to be drawn to, say, a fashion show, how, you know, the things that go down the clothes that go down the runway on a model at a fashion show in New York or Paris eventually are reflected in clothes that we might buy at Kohl's or Old Navy or what have you. Is the same thing at work in architecture? Are bold houses like these eventually reflected in the kinds of houses that more, I guess, general audiences might buy?
I think there's definitely some takeaway points from it. The one thread that wove itself throughout all these homes, regardless of size, regardless of perhaps the money that went into the design, was the fact that the homes were built to suit the owners, not the other way around. They weren't trying to fit themselves into this box. And that, I think, can be applied to any home. And a perfect example of that was the Ferris house that we feature, which was a 1970s bi-level, pretty nondescript. The owners moved in and decided they wanted to make it more suitable to their lifestyle. And if you were to see the pictures of the home before and what the home looks like now, it's not even recognizable. And yet it's a beautiful example of how a home is really about how you function within it. And I think that's the takeaway point.
And that is by far the smallest house that you feature in this, at like 1,300 square
right.
feet.
Right. I mean, it's pretty normal, smallish size. So it wasn't one of the grand examples. And yet it probably summarizes the heart of what this story was about when it came down to why owners live in the homes that they do.
Well, let's talk specifically about some of the houses that you feature, because some of them are really the stories behind them are pretty compelling, starting with the Redaction House, which it takes its inspiration from an unusual place for an architect, I would say.
It does. The idea came from the CIA letters when the CIA would want information to be read. It would come with a big black box over it to block it. And so the architects over at Johnson Schmaling took that same idea because when the owner found the site, it was a narrow site, had a nice view of the lake that they wanted to capitalize, but the owner didn't necessarily want to see some spec houses that were on the side of it. And so to do that, they designed the home in such a way that the windows really draw the eyes out to the view and block out the side views. But at the same time, it doesn't feel as if it's harsh or abrupt. It's a very flowing feeling within the home.
And this is you mentioned the lake. This is in Econimowoc.
Yes.
The other house that struck me, actually a lot of these houses struck me, but the Straw Bale home, which is Jalili Kohler's home.
Yes, this is probably my favorite one. And I don't know if it's because it was one of the homes I got to go into or because it's just so unique to the area and the fact that it's a straw bale home, which isn't something you see. And actually, I'm told it's the only one in the Milwaukee area.
And for people who don't know what a straw bale home is, what are we talking about?
The walls are made of straw. And she proved it. She told me that every straw bale home has to have a truth window. And so she took me right over to the kitchen where there were these little double wooden doors. And she opened them and it had a pane of glass in front of it. And sure enough, behind it, it was straw.
The straw is coated with wallboard in most places,
correct,
though.
Correct. Yes. It's not you're walking in like three
it's
little pigs.
It's not the
pig.
Three little
right.
pigs, exactly.
It's covered with stucco. It's a very almost Southwest feel when you walk into it.
Well, and it is in a unique community as well.
Right. When she decided to develop this property, she wanted to develop more than just homes. She wanted to develop a place that was eco-friendly, a place that really had some roots. And so those characteristics are carried out throughout all the homes in that complex. And hers especially, it has green roofs, it has little outdoor spaces, and everything within it has a story too, which is really neat, from tiles in the home that came from Kohler mansions and residences to even the wood that forms the staircase was once a trestle bridge.
the house that kind of kicks off this entire story, there's a big picture of it at the front of the story, and we get to read about it later, is the Levy House in Fox Point. And you're struck right away by the amount of glass that's involved. But the backstory of how that even happened is just as interesting.
It was going to be a kitchen remodel, and the kitchen remodel turned into building an entirely new home on the property. And it stemmed about because during the conversations of the kitchen remodel, the owners really came to the conclusion that they didn't use a lot of the space in their home, and they wanted to create a place where they felt connected not just to the property and the views that that property had, but also to each other. So the home is unique in that it does have a lot of glass to capitalize on those views, but it also has this feeling where you feel connected with the entire home. You can feel connected with the occupants within that home. And yet there are little nooks and spaces to have that privacy and that retreat.
What's the story of the Gradient House?
The Gradient home was of a similar concept, another case where the family really wanted to feel connected to each other. So it really was a home that not only feels connected to the land and that it was situated between two groves of existing trees, and you can almost see that kind of organic design in that the exterior of the home has these tall vertical panels that almost kind of resemble tree trunks in a way. So there's that feeling of being connected to the land, but also within the home, that same concept of being able to see through the home, being able to be connected without the rooms. And in the Gradient House in particular, if I'm not mistaken, this is the one where the public living spaces are divided from the private living spaces by two concrete walls almost, two concrete dividers. And that kind of keeps the areas separate yet connected.
Well, and finally, you also included a penthouse in the Kilbourne Tower, which is a much different animal than any of these other homes.
Mm-hmm. And that was kind of unique in that it isn't the typical home that you're going to be able to drive by. And yet it shows how you can take a space that maybe is high above the city, and yet through talking with the owners and the architects and the collaboration between the two, create a space that feels like home. And it very much is. It focuses a lot on the owner's love of family, love of friends, love of entertaining. And so the rooms really lend themselves to those aspects.
And maybe love of a really great view.
And a great view, that's for sure.
Would it be your hope that people would take an article like this and actually go for a literal Sunday drive and check out some of these places?
You know, I would hope so, because Milwaukee has some really unique spots and unique neighborhoods to check out. And I think, if nothing more, it's just kind of fun to see the history that lies here within our architecture and just see how it's influenced homes today.
Sarah Ray Lancaster, thank you so much.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Sarah Ray Lancaster's article, Dream Homes, a virtual if-only tour of some of the most spectacular, awesome, extraordinary houses in the metro area, is the cover story in the April issue of Milwaukee Magazine. That's Lake Effect for a Thursday morning. I'm Mitch Tyke. Great to have you listening this morning, as always. And I sure hope you'll tune in again tomorrow and every weekday morning at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee. Stay tuned. Fresh air is next. It's 11 o'clock.